Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling. So glad that you joined us on the broadcast today. We want to talk about a very important subject related to the issue of poverty. I'm sure that everyone in our listening audience, I can't think of a person who wouldn't be interested in this type of thing, but I would assume that everyone in our listening audience is interested in alleviating poverty. If you had it within your power to do so, I'm sure that everyone would want to alleviate that if at all possible. The problem is that sometimes there are unintended consequences associated with our efforts to alleviate poverty. There is actually something that is referred to as a helping that hurts. There's a way that we could actually, throughout the best intentions in the world, we could actually try to help a situation and then actually do the people involved in that situation positive harm. So that's what I want to look at today. I want to look at, specifically, in one specific area. I was reading a quote by somebody else, not related, I don't think, directly to our discussion today or to our author today, but it was under the topic of toxic charity, and the person there said, give once and you create appreciation, twice and you create anticipation, three times you create expectation, four times you create entitlement, and five times you create dependency. That was by Bob Lupton, made that particular quote, and that kind of capsulizes the idea that I'm talking about when I talk about that there is a helping that hurts. On the program today, we're going to speak with a fellow that has written a book about this subject. It's a subject that is written about fair trade versus free trade. The topic that we want to address today, it deals with that particular issue. Now, fair trade is an enormously popular idea in Christian and secular circles alike. Who, after all, could not or could be against fairness? But our special guest on the program today, Victor Clare, however, raises significant economic and moral questions about both the logic and the economic reasoning underlying the fair trade coffee movement. And so we're going to talk with him about his book today dealing with this subject, and we're also going to talk about this subject as it relates to the coffee industry. There's a fair trade movement involved in the coffee industry itself, and so we're going to relate a lot of our questions to that. Victor Clare, is that how you say Clare? Okay. Dr. Victor Clare is professor of economics at Henderson. It's a public liberal arts university in Arkansas where he specializes in teaching principles of economics courses. And his book is called Fair Trade, Its Prospects as a Poverty Solution. So that's what we're thinking about, poverty solutions. Is fair trade the way to go? Or is free trade really the way to go? With that, Dr. Clare, welcome to the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Good morning, Kevin.
Dr. Clare, maybe a good place for us to start is for you to tell us a little bit about your work there, the teaching that you do, and maybe a little bit of a synopsis of your book. I mentioned it, but I didn't give a detailed outline as to what folks would find in that book.
Sure. My work, we talked about working with poverty. I have the blessing every day at work to get to work with a lot of first-generation college students here at Henderson. Mm. We're the one public liberal arts university in the state of Arkansas system, and roughly 50% of our freshmen are the first ever in their families to attend college. Mm. So I get to work with a lot of students who would love to have a liberal arts education, but unless they're really, really outstanding financially, that may not be possible for their families. So I get to work with them on a daily basis, and it's a blessing and a joy.
Praise the Lord. How is Poverty Cure associated with that as well?
Poverty Cure is an initiative that's affiliated with the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And Poverty Cure, just like the name sounds, it's not really about poverty alleviation or poverty reduction. It's really about seeking the long-term cures for poverty and understanding better what causes poverty in the first place, and getting the diagnosis right helps people who genuinely care about poverty curing figure out what the right treatment is for the patient.
Mm-hmm. So you're teaching at Henderson and teaching about these economic principles and, of course, then looking at poverty under that area. But then you're also, some of your articles appear out on Poverty Cure as well as out on the Acton Institute as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I frequently give some lectures for the Acton Institute, and I do some writing for them also, particularly lately about fair trade.
Okay. And then your book is also, is that associated with any of those other groups, or is that something independent of both of those groups?
That's exactly right. That was originally commissioned by the Acton Institute, and then it was reissued for the Poverty Cure series.
Okay. And what do you, give us a little synopsis then of what people would find if they picked up your book, and what is the basic issue that you're addressing, and how thorough do you go into that in that particular book?
Sure. It's a short book. It's about 75 pages long. And what I try to do in that book is put on my hat as an economist and go to the literature and read everything that I could read about fair trade, and in particular about fair trade coffee, mm-hmm. but then explain it so that it's accessible to any caring Christian who wants to know whether or not fair trade coffee and other fair trade initiatives can genuinely lead to long-term poverty reduction and eventually poverty cure.
Mm-hmm. So we mentioned coffee as associated with fair trade, but it's not the only industry that's involved in this. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There are basically two kinds of fair trade goods. One kind is arts and crafts, and if people have ever seen a 10,000 Villages store, then that's probably where they've seen the arts and crafts movement most heavily. 10,000 Villages is a network of distributors that does some wonderful work bringing you truly unique, beautiful, handcrafted goods and services from other countries, and they help those artisans and craftspeople get access to markets they wouldn't have access to otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Coffee, though, even though it's not the only industry that's involved in this movement of fair trade, it seems to be one of the most popular ones. I don't know if because coffee is so trendy today, you know, with Starbucks and these types of things. But for some reason, when you think about fair trade, you almost automatically associate it with coffee. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The other kind of fair trade initiative has more to do with commodities. And you're exactly right. The biggest and the most visible commodity that you can buy as part of a fair trade initiative is coffee. But there are lots of other goods, too. You can buy fair trade chocolates and fair trade tea and fair trade bananas. You can even now buy fair trade soccer balls.
Mm.
So there's a large and growing network of the fair trade goods and, in particular, fair trade commodities.
Okay, well, let's talk then about the subject of fair trade itself. How about we start with a working definition? What do we mean by fair trade? And is fair trade then a good thing or a bad thing?
Okay, so using the term as it's applied to goods like coffee and tea and chocolate, fair trade basically consists of guaranteeing a minimum price that small cooperatives, in the case of coffee, small cooperatives of coffee growers, receive regardless of what happens to the market price of coffee. So whether the price of coffee, no matter how low the price of a pound of coffee goes in international markets, small coffee growers who have a connection to the Fair Trade Network receive a guaranteed minimum price per pound. And that's good because, it's good for them, because coffee prices move around a lot for reasons that I'm sure we'll get into in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice for them, especially if you're a poor person and you're never sure exactly what you'll be able to sell your crop for at the end of the season. It's nice to reduce some of that risk a little bit and receive a guaranteed minimum price.
Let me ask, this may backtrack just a tad, but when we talk about a guaranteed minimum price,
mm-hmm.
it kind of assumes that there was a time period where these growers were being taken advantage of, that they were, their goods were being sold at a lot less than what they were worth. Maybe we should also kind of paint the picture of what the problem, or at least the perceived problem, was with coffee growing to start with, and then we'll come right back to this idea of a guaranteed minimum price.
Yeah, that sounds great. People who are advocates for fair trade, and especially fair trade coffee, they point to the fact that coffee prices do move around a lot, and they do. If you look at the price of any commodity, whether it's a barrel of oil or the price of a pound of coffee, those coffee prices move around a lot, and they move around mostly because when prices fluctuate, you and I don't change our coffee drinking habits by very much.
Mm-hmm.
And even if coffee prices go through the roof and coffee growers would love to sell us more coffee, they can't respond very quickly because it's an agricultural commodity, and they can't overnight respond to that price signal and deliver more coffee immediately. It takes a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So because coffee prices move around so much, then one of the arguments for fair trade is if you guarantee this minimum, then people who are living in poor countries growing coffee will be insulated from some of that risk.
Mm. Is the technical term elastic? Is that what the term is?
Yeah, when we talk about how quickly the suppliers can respond in a short amount of time, the term that economists use is we say that the supply is price inelastic. And what that means is even when prices move around a lot, it's difficult in a short amount of time for growers to respond, even though they would love to, because at a given moment, they have a given acreage that they've already planted. And in the case of coffee, even if the price spikes like it did in 2010, it might be 2 to 5 years before newly planted coffee plants are ready to yield a harvest.
Mm-hmm. So they're looking at the folks that are growing these coffee in these, I don't know if it would be considered third world countries, but poor, impoverished areas. And they're saying, you know, the price is going up and down, and these people's livelihood is dependent upon this. So we're going to get involved here, and we're going to not allow people, first of all, to take advantage of these people and their growing, but also we're going to try to make this a much more stable environment by guaranteeing the price that they're going to receive for their coffee. So here's where the problem begins, I would imagine. The problem begins when you tell somebody that you can guarantee the price.
Sure. When I think about fair trade coffee, I'm reminded of jobs that I had when I was a kid. And I think about starting at age 11, I delivered newspapers door-to-door in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania.
Me too.
And, of course, it's back when we had door-to-door delivery of newspapers by children. And then I think of my job when I was in high school. I worked part-time after school and on Saturdays in the local hardware store in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. And when I think about those jobs, in terms of the quality of the work and how much fun it was for me, those were terrific jobs. And you know what? Looking back on those jobs, whether it was being outside and meeting people with the paper out, or working at a hardware store and serving customers and doing it well, you know, if those jobs had paid enough, I would probably still be doing one or possibly both of those jobs
mm-hmm.
because I really didn't mind the work. And if they paid me just enough to keep me doing that, I might very well still be doing those things.
Mm.
And that's kind of the temptation of fair trade coffee, and it connects nicely with the quote you brought in from Bob Lupton in toxic charity,
mm-hmm.
that if you make something look a little more attractive than it used to look, then you risk that, then you run a risk that people will continue doing that thing rather than moving on to the next thing.
Mm. I actually worked in a company that was like that. The company paid a decent wage, but there was no upward mobility in the company whatsoever. It was there was just nothing there. There was nowhere to go. And the problem was that a number of guys had spent, they were in a position early on that they needed a job like that. And so they, because they were in school and so forth, and so they needed the flexibility and the job was convenient that way. However,
right.
after they had put in a number of years in the company, it was now to the point that if they jumped ship and they went to another company, they were going to end up probably taking a little bit of a pay cut. And then they would, but they would have much more upward mobility and opportunity for growth in their careers. And
right.
but they found themselves stuck because the place that they were at, even though it was always going to be right around that same amount of money, same amount of opportunity, they just couldn't do it because of the risk involved and because of the just getting comfortable in the job and so forth. And so I used to refer to it as an opportunity cost or an opportunity loss, that they were losing out. They were losing out much more than they really were putting into the equation when they thought about these things. Is that a fair illustration, you think, of what you were talking about?
That's a fair illustration, and I think that's one of the struggles that parents go through all the time is they want to get the balance right in terms of loving and caring for their children and making sure that their immediate needs are met, but at the same time, they need to make sure that life is sufficiently uncomfortable mm-hmm. that they move out of the house eventually,
mm-hmm.
gain full employment, and in a society, whether it's a national society or a global economy, the bottom rung really shouldn't be very comfortable. The bottom rung, the first rung, that hopefully you move from pretty quickly, needs to be a little uncomfortable so that mm-hmm. advancing and moving up to the second rung is attractive enough to make that move.
Mm. When you start talking about that failure to launch, as they say here in the South, Dr. Clara, you've gone to meddling. And so... Let me ask you then, with the fair trade, how does that actually work? Explain the process as to, how do the growers get involved, and then the idea of putting this fair trade stamp on the coffee, what does that say to the people that buy that coffee, and some of those elements involved in this process?
Sure. So if you walk into, since I'm in Arkansas, I'll use Walmart as an example because I know it well.
Mm-hmm.
If you walk into a Walmart today in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, and you pick up a bag of the Great Value Espresso Roast that has the Fair Trade seal on it, what that means is that the importer and roaster of Walmart's coffee has received a license to use that stamp from an international labeling agency, sanctioning agency called Fair Trade Labeling Organizations, although they've recently changed the name simply to Fair Trade International.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're guaranteeing when you see that stamp is that the coffee was, in most cases, grown by cooperatives of small coffee growers. And the way that those fair trade coffee growers get access so that their beans can be in that bag and not somebody else's, is they have to, small cooperatives of coffee growers, have to first apply for access to the Fair Trade Network. And it requires a substantial application fee, sometimes thousands of dollars, depending on how big the crop will be. The poor coffee growers have to come up with an application fee of several thousand dollars. And they also have to work to find somebody in the United States or in another fair trade importing country who's interested in buying the coffee that they're making available at that guaranteed minimum price.
Mm. The fee I saw, too, in one of the articles that first caught my attention, this was out on the blog on the Acton organization, said that the fee was $3,200. So pretty substantial. And as you were mentioning, other requirements going along with it. The growers may not use child labor. Coffee growers may not hire laborers. They need to rely upon family members. And they, in order to get that certificate, they have to pay that application fee of $3,200. So that's on their end. That's on the end of the people that are actually growing the coffee. Does it actually work? And what happens then, or what's that supposed to do to people on our end that see that label? What are they supposed to get out of this?
Right. Well, on our end, when you buy that bag of fair trade certified coffee at Walmart, it gives you an assurance that the coffee growers are in fact receiving the guaranteed minimum, and presumably that the coffee was grown under those promised conditions by the Fair Trade International organization. The other thing that you get is, and economists have different ways to refer to this, one possibility is that you get sort of a warm glow feeling, that even though you can't see the good that you're doing when you buy the fair trade coffee because you've been given an assurance by skillful marketing that you are doing some good when you buy the fair trade coffee, then you can feel a little bit better about yourself and that you're serving the Lord in ways that you're called to do when you buy the fair trade label as opposed to the coffee that doesn't have that fair trade certification.
Mm-hmm. So what are the problems then? If that's what's going on, we start entering into, okay, so why doesn't that work? What does it actually do?
Well, there are a couple of ways to attack that question. One is to look at how much of the money that consumers are paying is actually getting all the way up the supply chain to the poor coffee growers that they're trying to help. And in one coffee shop I know well, if you walk in and you buy a cup of regular coffee versus fair trade coffee, they charge roughly 25 cents more per cup for the guaranteed fair trade than they do for the coffee that's not guaranteed to be fair trade. And if you do a little quick arithmetic, you realize very, very soon that coffee growers in the poor countries you're trying to help should be getting a lot more than the guaranteed minimum price for coffee. Right now, the guaranteed minimum is roughly $1.35 a pound. And since it doesn't take a lot of ground coffee to make a single brewed cup or a single fair trade espresso or a fair trade cappuccino, if caring customers are all paying an extra 25 cents a cup, then a lot of money is going missing between the counter at your local coffee shop and the eventual small coffee growers that you're trying to help. So one of the problems is that the simple math simply doesn't add up. People are giving a lot of extra money to buy fair trade coffee, especially at retail outlets, and that money simply isn't making it all the way up the supply chain.
Is that money then being siphoned off by the administration of the free trade organizations?
Yeah, a lot of the money goes to administration and marketing, administration of the fair trade network, administration of the importers and roasters that are bringing in the fair trade coffee in the first place. And also a lot of it goes to licensing, just like you have to pay extra to put that certified NFL label hologram on a famous NFL player's jersey. It costs quite a bit of money to get that fair trade stamp on a bag of coffee. So there are lots of costs that add up along the way, long before you get to the eventual fair trade coffee grower that you're trying to help.
So just to start with on the issues here, I don't know that how that would make the end consumer feel. He thinks, hey, I'm helping out a poor farmer in a poverty-stricken area somewhere around the world. And yet to discover, it, right here in our initial problems that we are going through, to discover that, you've actually created a whole nother industry, or you're funding a whole nother area. You know, you're funding marketing, you're funding the administration of this thing, as well as trying to help out the folks there in these other countries. I think some people would be a little bit disappointed with that. Is that the general feeling that you get when you expose that?
Yeah, that's the general gist. One of the conclusions that we can talk about later is in many ways, when you buy fair trade coffee, it's for most of us, it's a charitable act. And if you do the arithmetic, though, it's a pretty inefficient one in terms of how much good is actually being accomplished per dollar spent. So one thing that the caring Christian could think about is, would the extra money that I'm paying for fair trade coffee actually serve the Lord and the poor more effectively if instead of buying fair trade coffee, I did something else with the money I would have used when I'm buying the fair trade coffee?
And I want to get to that. I want to get to one of the solutions that you mentioned is, you know, you could actually just have a relationship with the people on the field. If you were a seller over here and you were buying from a grower in another country, you know, if you just had a personal relationship with him, I like that idea of just, you know, one-on-one accountability that way rather than having some organization, you know, put their stamp literally upon, you know, this process. We'll talk about that some more when we come back from the break. Let me tell our listening audience that we're speaking with Dr. Victor Klar. He's the professor of economics at Henderson. It's the public liberal arts university in Arkansas, where he specializes in teaching principles of economic courses there. He also has a book out called Fair Trade, Its Prospects as a Poverty Solution. And I'll tell you where you can find that and get that when we come back from the break. We're talking about the difference between fair trade and free trade, primarily in the coffee industry. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
Every day on the Janet Mefford Show, we take a look at the news of the day, both in the church and in the world, from a distinctly Christ-centered perspective. We talk to the day's biggest newsmakers about the stories and issues you care about and examine everything in light of the Word of God. Best of all, we get perspective on the issues when we hear from the most important person of all, you. So tune in and get ready for a biblical perspective on everything going on in your world. Tune in to the very next Janet Mefford Show.
Weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on Christian Talk 660 and 92.9.
Hi, this is R.C. Sproul. Last year, we launched Ligonier Connect, an online learning experience designed to let you study the Word of God with trustworthy scholars and theologians by watching video lectures, posting answers to questions, and interacting with classmates. Today, I'm pleased to announce we've added several new courses from the Ligonier Teaching Fellows, Sinclair Ferguson, Robert Godfrey, Stephen Lawson, and R.C. Sproul, Jr. Probably the most popular enhancement is the new option for unlimited access for only $9 a month. This gives you access to every course. That's over 40 courses in biblical studies, theology, Christian living, and more. I hope that Ligonier Connect will be an encouragement as you study the Word of God and learn of His holiness. Why don't you give it a try? To learn more or to subscribe today, visit ligonier.org/connect. or call 800-435-4343.
This is Michael Brown, CEO and team leader of Keller Williams Realty Upstate. Keller Williams Realty Upstate is proud to have a company with a belief system that is an essential part of who we are and how we conduct business. Our goal, God, family, business, is our driving force. We're also proud of the great people we serve and would like to talk to you about a career at Keller Williams Real Estate. Call us at 234-7500 or log on to joinkwupstate.com.
Last thing I remember saying bye to yesterday. Glad to see it over, pulling covers over my head. What were you doing while I dreamt the night away? Cause I can tell that something's different and my eyes ain't even open yet. I'm smelling coffee, birds are singing just outside. Here comes your mercy. While I've been dreaming, you've been singing over me, yeah. Singing about my freedom, waking me up to hear your song. Now I can't dance hard enough, cause yesterday is gone, gone, gone. I'm smelling coffee.
Well, there you have it. Good morning. We thought that song would fit really well with the subject that we're talking about today. We've been talking about the coffee industry, and even more specifically, the difference between fair trade and free trade. We're going to continue that conversation in just a minute with our special guest, Dr. Victor Klar. And I wanted to mention, though, you didn't get to hear it, the folks that are listening here in the via the radio waves, but out on the website, out on sermonaudio.com, during the commercial, we actually played a little book trailer for an upcoming interview that I'll be doing next Tuesday. Kevin Swanson will be joining me on Tuesday. He's got a brand new book out called Apostate. And get it while you can, it says underneath. It has a really clever book trailer associated with it. It shows him in the little prison cell, and he's been arrested, and he's saying, you know, how this came about 15 years ago. He wrote a book called Apostate, and then he, you know, the guards are coming, so he hides his little smartphone and says, you know, get the book. So he's very clever. This book is very interesting. He looks at a number of figures throughout history that have led to the downfall of Western society. So that's what we'll be talking about on Tuesday's broadcast. Kevin Swanson joining us for the broadcast then. On the broadcast today, we've been looking at, as I mentioned, the subject of fair trade versus free trade with Dr. Victor Klar. I mentioned just before the break that I would let you know where you can go out to get a copy of his book. I found a copy of the book. I think you can get it just off of Amazon, of course. But I saw a copy of it out on Poverty Cure. That website is www.povertycure.org. That's povertycure.org. And then you can just look in the library under there. There's a tab for library, and you can go there. And the book is called Fair Trade, Its Prospects as a Poverty Solution. It's very affordable. You can get it on Kindle. I think the Kindle price there is only, what, $2.99. So it's very affordable. I wonder, I got to talk to Dr. Klar about if he would like to see a guaranteed price for his book. you know, this idea of guaranteed prices, that you know, it's got a good side and a bad side to it. So anyways, and we're talking about that subject. I also mentioned a couple of other websites along the way. I mentioned the Acton Institute. The blog I was reading from was from www.acton.org, and there's a blog out there that is written by Sarah Stanley, and her blog post is entitled, Is Fair Trade Coffee Curing Poverty? Dave Kruver originally posted that out on Facebook. I saw his post and was reading through this article and got interested in the story. So if you want to read from another person looking at this issue, she had attended a conference that was given by Dr. Klar as well as Travis Hester, and they were given a talk and about fair trade versus free trade. She attended that and then wrote a blog about that, and so you can read about that that information. Let's go back to our discussion now. If you have any questions on this subject, you're certainly welcome to participate in the program today. Two ways for you to do it. I have a toll-free number set up. It's good nationwide. That number is 1-888-660-WLFJ. That's 1-888-660-9535. Be happy to take your question or comment. Also, I have email up and running, and the email is Kevin. I wanted to do that again. I want to give you the old email address. The new email address is kttradio@gmail.com. That's kttradio@gmail.com, and you can shoot me a quick email that way, and I'll work your comment in that way. Okay, back to our discussion. Dr. Klar, we started to talk about some of the negative elements associated with what's wrong with the fair trade, and you articulated the first one there. Let's go a little bit further then. What are some of the other problems? For instance, like is there a problem associated with an artificially high price when you guarantee a price and the price fluctuates? Is there a problem then with having that artificially high price?
Right. Well, one way I like to think of it is that the problem isn't necessarily coffee. In fact, I would argue that fair trade coffee is kind of a Band-Aid. It's like a piece of duct tape on a bigger problem. Mm. And the bigger problem is that we have trade that's unfair in between rich developed nations like ours and poor developing nations that would love to do business with us.
Mm.
And to take just two examples, right now it is illegal in the United States to buy sugar that comes from any country but our own. And to take another example, we heavily subsidize cotton growers in the southern part of the United States, including places like Arkansas and West Texas. And that makes it very difficult for poor cotton growers in other nations who would love to sell us cotton to get access to our markets and compete with us.
Mm.
And so fair trade coffee is kind of this Band-Aid, because you have people who are currently growing coffee because it's their best available option, when in fact if we had a level playing field for everybody, they would be perfectly positioned to move into producing goods and services and doing all kinds of work that they're not currently doing because they don't have that opportunity.
Mm. Yeah, that certainly turns the whole thing on its head, doesn't it? Looking at it from a completely different perspective, and not, you know, we talk about this phrase, picking winners and losers, but by eliminating people from the process, we end up doing that very thing, don't we?
Right. In fact, your listeners have probably already guessed why we in the United States don't have any trade protections against coffee, and it's because you can't grow coffee in places like Ohio or Nebraska, because if you could grow coffee in the United States, I can guarantee that there would be a coffee lobby that was working hard to keep coffee from other nations out.
Okay.
And so if we really care about human beings wherever they live and making advances, and we don't think in terms of us versus them, you know, we Americans versus the other people, then there'd be an opportunity for human flourishing for everybody in ways that aren't happening because we don't allow those opportunities to be fully utilized.
Mm. So back to the idea of the guaranteed price.
Right.
The guaranteed price then has a number of unintended consequences to it as well. Articulate a couple of those for us.
Well, one of the unintended consequences is just like our slanted trade policy, this guaranteed minimum price looks extremely attractive to people who are currently growing coffee, and it's their best available option. So one of the things that it's done is it's actually created an incentive for people to grow even more coffee than they were before, or for some people who weren't even growing any coffee to move into coffee production because of the lure of this guaranteed minimum price. And I understand that completely. If you're a desperately poor person with few options, then having this opportunity available makes sense, but it also then nudges you into doing something that is never going to pay very well as a long-term strategy.
Hmm. We've talked a lot then about fair trade. Let's talk about free trade. You mentioned it just a moment ago, and just saying that, you know, we need to open this up. But let's very specifically talk about why free trade is better than fair trade.
Well, one of the great things about the market mechanism, and as a Christian economist, I believe deeply that market systems are part of God's divine providence. It's part of his creation. And one of the great things about prices is they constantly send messages to all of us about things to do more of, because people really, really need that to happen. And they also send signals about what to do less of, because there's currently too much. And anytime you interfere with those signals that prices send, and fair trade coffee is an example of this, then you nudge people into activities that are probably less viable as a long-term strategy than the other opportunities they would pursue instead.
Hmm.
So in the case of fair trade coffee, you make it look a little more attractive to grow coffee, especially since, again, people living in poor nations with the right climate can't grow sugar for us. You nudge them into doing things that aren't long-term strategies. So genuinely, free trade would allow price signals to send very valuable information to all of us about the places that we can serve our fellow human beings most effectively, given what we currently have to offer in the marketplace.
Mm. I had mentioned early on that the solution then was a partnership or individual accountability, I like to put it that way, between the people selling the coffee and the people and then who they're buying from. Is that part of the solution that, you know, those people, they could go there and see the farm for themselves? They could interact with the people. They could decide, hey, I don't like the way this guy does business. I'm going to use somebody else. Is that really part of the solution there as well?
That can potentially be part of the solution. There's a new buzzword. It's not fair trade, but it's called sometimes direct trade.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is to do exactly that, form partnerships with people you actually know and can meet. And this harkens back to the days of the very beginning of the fair trade coffee movement. 25 years ago, there were junkets when people who were buying coffee would go visit the very growers they'd been buying coffee from. And you could see whether or not there'd been changes in their standard of living. You could see whether they'd been able to do community projects. And we've really lost that. Fair trade has become so big that it's almost impossible to know how much good you're actually doing when you pay a little bit extra for a cup of coffee. So this new initiative that some people call direct trade at least has the appeal that now there can be more of a personal connection to the people that you're trying to help, because you can know them and maybe occasionally go check out what's going on and what the conditions look like.
And then for the end consumer buying that cup of coffee, they would have to trust that the company that they're buying that coffee from, that they had done their due diligence, and if they found problems with a certain supplier, that they would switch to some other supplier, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And another thing to keep in mind that we haven't mentioned yet is just because a fair trade coffee grower has a contract, so suppose that I'm growing coffee in Central America, and I have a fair trade coffee contract with an American importer and roaster of coffee. Just because I have that contract doesn't mean that American importer will be interested in buying all of my coffee in a given growing season. So sometimes we tend to think when we talk about fair trade coffee that it's a guaranteed market, and it's really not that for the growers. It just guarantees they'll be able to sell at least some of their crop to an American importer at the guaranteed price. But the rest of the coffee crop might very well end up in the conventional coffee market anyway. So if you walk down to Walmart and you buy a bag of coffee that doesn't say fair trade, there's an excellent chance it was actually grown by a fair trade grower, but the fair trade grower wasn't able to sell all of it to his fair trade importer.
In the end of the article that I read, the blog post out on the Acton.org website, Sarah sums up your presentation this way. She says, in the end, Clare cautions the fair trade movement is a marketing scheme. When you pay an extra for a cup of fair trade coffee, you're paying to look like a caring person or to feel like a caring person, but you're not necessarily helping coffee growers. Spending more money on a cup of fair trade coffee is seen as an act of social responsibility. Basically, the organizations leading the movement are attempting to bundle charity or social justice with coffee. Do you feel that that's a good summary of our conversation today about that subject?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you ask what's really in it for the consumer, most coffee drinkers I know, especially people who are serious about their coffee, whether they buy fair trade or not, the one thing they care about most is this good value and is this cup of coffee delicious or not? Mm-hmm. And then if they happen to buy fair trade coffee, it depends on two things. One, that they feel like they're getting this warm glow from doing the right thing. And then also, if you're a little more cynical, as many economists are, then you think that people might be buying fair trade coffee so they look like a caring person, whether they actually are or not, because looking like a caring person can have some social benefits. Right? If people think, if I go to class and I have a fair trade coffee mug, my students are going to think, wow, Dr. Clare, he's a good guy. He really cares. So the short story is, if you want to pay a little bit extra for coffee, then the thing to do is And this, a colleague of mine, Colleen Haight, has put it this way. One of the things you should do is buy the highest quality coffee you can afford, whether it's fair trade or not, because just like as is the case in any other good or service, when the production quality is high, then the prices, the markets will reward the producers, including the migrant workers who are working in the fields making that delicious coffee. So instead of buying fair trade coffee, buy really good coffee, because more of that money will actually go to the coffee growers that you're trying to help.
Hmm. What do you recommend then to people? You recommend in coffee there, you know, that they go ahead and buy the highest quality coffee, and that's a good recommendation for everybody involved, even for the coffee drinker. And but what do you recommend about trying to be involved in relieving poverty itself in a more general sense? I noticed out on one of the websites that we were referring to, Poverty Cure, that they talk about a shift from alleviating poverty to creating prosperity. Talk just briefly in the closing minutes of the broadcast here about just, you know, do we need a shift in our thinking on this thing?
Yeah, maybe we do need a slight shift. And as an economist and with thousands of years to look at, I can tell you three things that lift people out of poverty more quickly than any other initiatives. One thing is genuinely free trade, which we've mentioned already.
Mm-hmm.
A second one is when people have more skills that they bring into the workplace. So organizations that do great work developing nutrition and education, like just as one example, Compassion International that we support in my Sunday school class, they do a great job of helping create more value in the human person. Because one reality of the market system is if you want to command more earning, whether you're currently rich or you're currently poor or you're someplace in between, if you want to be able to earn more in an hour, you need to be able to create more value in an hour than you currently do.
Hmm.
And having basic language skills and things we take for granted, basic language skills, basic math skills, those things are extremely valuable in a global marketplace. And if you have access to those and other what economists call human capital, the creativity and the ability and the talent that's inside of you, then those things ultimately lead to lasting gains in a global marketplace. Hmm. And then the third one is better tools for the job. One of the reasons that the micro, though it's not perfect everywhere, that the micro lending initiatives, one of the reasons that those things have gotten so much attention is because for very poor entrepreneurs in developing countries, the difference between some business and no business might be the smallest tool in the world, but they can't currently afford it. I think back to my Fulbright year in the former Soviet Republic of Armenia, and there was a fellow whose business was sitting on a stool outside the big chain grocery shop, and he had a bathroom scale, and if you walked by, you could give him a little money, and he would weigh you, and you could find out your weight. But without that bathroom scale, that gentleman has no business. And so sometimes we forget that even the simplest tools can mean the difference for a poor person between creating more value in an hour and not being able to create much value at all. So if you can find ways to help build human beings and also put good tools in their hands, then those things can lead to lasting growth and prosperity.
Hmm. And there's a lot of other less tangible elements associated with that, right? I mean, not just the bottom line, not just the how much money is made, but there's a dignity that comes along with earning the money rather than just having the money handed to you as well. And that's a very important element in this whole process.
That's exactly right. As a Christian, I deeply believe that the image of God is embedded, ingrained in all of us, and that genuine human flourishing happens when we exercise good stewardship of what we've been blessed with, and we become the people that God intends us to be through service to others.
Mm-hmm. One final question, Dr. Clara, if I could get you just to address in the closing minute of the broadcast. Christians, a lot of times, are easy marks for a lot of this type of charity, this indiscriminate, or what Marvin Olasky termed in his book, their promiscuous giving, that just, you know, hey, give to this cause. You know, if you're really a Christian, you care about people, just, you know, open up your wallet and give. What's your word of counsel to the Christian community about this type of charity in general?
I think the more information you can get about what your money is actually being used for, the better. And I think that, especially in the United States, we've become affluent enough now that there are a lot of third-party organizations that are doing a lot of fine work, letting you know if you give a dollar to Charity X, how much of that dollar is actually being used for mission versus overhead. And so organizations like GuideStar, for example, can give us some great information about where our dollars are being used. But I'd say, you know, that's great. But the main one is careful prayer. I mean, it's a great thing when our family sits down with the money that we want to give in service to the Lord, and we pray over each and every dollar that we allocate, because it's a joy, but it also comes with great responsibility. Mm-hmm. And serving the poor as effectively as we can is critical to the life of the Christian.
Mm, well said. Well, Dr. Klar, thank you so much for joining us today on the broadcast. Thanks for writing about these things. It's been very helpful. I'll feel better about drinking my coffee tomorrow morning. And so that's important. And so I just thank you so much for spending some time with us here today on the broadcast.
Thank you, Kevin.
All righty. Again, that was Dr. Victor Klar. He's actually teaches. He's a professor of economics at Henderson, a public liberal arts university in Arkansas, where he specializes in teaching the principles of economics. He also is an author. The book is entitled Fair Trade, Its Prospects as a Poverty Solution. And then, as we were mentioning, he blogs or he writes various articles out on a couple of different websites. The one website that I was referring to was Poverty Cure. They've got a lot of interesting articles out there, www.povertycure.org. That's povertycure.org. And then also, and that's where you can find Dr. Klar's book out there as well. And then also we were talking about the Acton.org was another site that we were talking about, and there's a number of articles out there about these topics as well. One book on this subject that's always I refer to a lot, but it's been a real blessing to me, and that was the book written by Marvin Olasky, and it was entitled The Tragedy of American Compassion. And basically, Marvin locked himself in the Library of Congress, and he pored over a number of documents that talked about how we had done charity historically in this country. And the bottom line to the whole book was that it was typically done with a measure of accountability associated with it. There wasn't this promiscuous giving, you know, this giving of money without any strings attached type of thing. But there was always some level of accountability associated with it. Oftentimes, if a person needs money that way, there are other problems that need to be dealt with in their life, and you would do them much more help if you would deal with those problems rather than just handing the money out indiscriminately. A lot of interesting things we've talked about this week. You can check them all out on our website. But remember this. The Lord Jesus Christ said, He said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.